This week, helping migrant women settle into regional centres. A special multicultural women's group in Rockhampton is offering friendship and some motherly advice to those in need. Also, we learn about aquaponics from some pretty cute five-year-olds and get the lowdown on low-line cattle. What they may lack in size, they certainly make up for in flavour. We'll also visit an organic market garden on Queensland's Sunshine Coast that's under attack from native wood ducks.
Done my pak choy, my buk choy, my cos, my oaks. So I didn't even harvest the oaks or the cos. So yeah, massacre. But they don't eat the coriander. My beetroot's okay. But yeah, leafy greens. What can I do?
What indeed, Mick Warren's quack attack later in the program. But let's start our travels today in central Queensland, where migrant women are helping each other to settle into their new community.
My name is Zilpa Musafiri. I come from Congo in Africa.
My name is Resham. People know me as Erati. I'm from Nepal.
My name is Premila Fries and I'm from Fiji.
I'm Shah. I'm from Myanmar or Burma.
They come from all over the world, but these women have one thing in common. They've all made a home for themselves in the regional centre of Rockhampton in central Queensland. Some are refugees.
Because Congo is not a safe country, every day war up to now. Now we came here from camp refugees in Uganda. Now we are happy to stay here because we are safe.
Some are here to study.
I am here over scholarship and I'm studying nursing, so I've been here for about 4 years.
Others came to Australia for love.
I got married and I came here in 1986.
Hello, I'm Blythe Moore. If you were born and raised in Australia, you might think managing day-to-day life here is pretty straightforward. But for people who move here as adults, accessing things like healthcare and education, going shopping, even finding a job can be fraught with challenges. But help is at hand. The Central Queensland Multicultural Association has set up its first women's group. They meet every Tuesday morning, offering friendship and help, even some motherly advice to anyone who comes along. This is especially important to nursing student Shah Mui from Myanmar, who's been homesick since arriving in Rockhampton 4 months ago.
I have been homesick a lot, and then so far I can't find any Burmese person, and I'm the only one from my country, so I've been feeling so lonely, and then here I don't have a lot of activities to do.
Shah's been coming to the women's group since it began earlier this year and says it's been a way to make friends and a community.
Most of them are mothers. They ask me everything, are you okay or how is your school going? It's good to be asked such questions. Sometimes I want to say I have problems and I felt such. Yeah, it's always good to know that you are not alone.
Resham Bhattari had her own set of challenges when she first arrived from Nepal, but time has made things easier.
Oh, there's so many challenges, but nowadays it's becoming more multicultural. And then there was a lot of challenges because sometimes people didn't understand my pronunciation and then I didn't understand their pronunciation or whatever they're asking. And that was the big problem. And then once I used to with the people going out and then talking with them, once I start to used to with them, and then it's easier for me to understand them. And then they also feel easier to, understand my pronunciation. And then different culture, that's obviously the most challengeable.
So what has this group meant for you?
Oh, this is a lot. Because they're doing, Theresa, our CISA mentor, and then she introduced a lot of different multicultural women, and then we make a friend here that gives us more, comfortable and easy to talk with them, and then share our sometimes happiness, sometimes grief as well. Like, that makes us very meaningful.
There's even a born and bred Aussie in the group. Swimming teacher Sonia Galvin joined up so she could learn more about the children she coaches.
I was exposed to multicultural families that were coming to me for swimming lessons, doctors from the base hospital, sort of their children, and I was concerned that I wasn't interacting with the children as I was with other children, with facial expressions, with if they were yelling out to their parents. They were Sudan African families that I had, and Filipino families and Maori families, but the Sudan African children were the ones that I was struggling with. I didn't know if they were excited or on the verge of crying, of being frightened, and I just didn't comprehend what they were trying to sort of come across with, and some of their language was different, so different to what I'd been involved with. I've been nowhere myself, I've never travelled, so it's been a really big eye-opener for me. So being able to help the ladies here with stuff is just fantastic for me, and it's just, yeah, lovely.
Really rewarding.
Very rewarding.
The group does a range of activities like food decoration and sewing. It's all funded by an organisation called Community Action for a Multicultural Society, otherwise known as CAMS. The facilitator is Teresa Stanky.
It's quite surprising when you see people, how many different women there are from so many different countries living in Rockhampton, and this is just a small snapshot.
It is, and I've been away for 3 years, and I'm amazed how there's new communities, new groups of communities that we're having. So it's really good that we're all coming together. And when we come in the space, where you come from, we don't look at that. We look at it as all sisters in this space. You know, they could have experienced suppression in speech, you know, rights, women's rights and all that. So we've allowed it. But it's been gradual because you don't want to go too quickly with that. You have to be very sensitive and allow. And fortunately, it has worked. And they're from Bangladesh, Nepal, PNG, Congo, Liberia, and then I'm getting the mainstream Australians coming in, which is brilliant because that's exactly what we're working towards. And I think Rockhampton's really changing. The fabric of the community is really changing, and it's really nice to have something like this to assist that integration.
My name is Cooper.
What do we have here, Cooper?
The aquaponics system.
What does aquaponics do?
It picks up the poo from the fish with the plants.
He might just be 5 years old, but young Cooper here and his classmates have a pretty good handle on how an aquaponics system works. And they're looking forward to eating the fruits of their labours. There's lots of water here. What does the water do?
Flood.
Yeah, it floods our aquaponics system. And then what happens? What do the clay balls do with the water?
Pick the poo up because it dirties the water.
Hello, Lisa Herbert with you. I'm at Girraween Primary School on the outskirts of Darwin in the Northern Territory. Outside one of the classrooms, a simple aquaponics system has been set up. There's a tank housing goldfish and young barramundi, linked to an old bathtub and some potted plants. Put simply, the nutrient-rich water from the fish pond, or fish poo as these kids like to call it, is used to fertilise and grow the plants. What's in the tank at the end of all this?
Turtles and fish.
So that water from the turtles and the fish?
Pumps it up.
Yep, it's being pumped into this bathtub. What's in this bathtub?
Tomato, basil.
Miss Ashley Libetta, teacher at Girraween Primary School.
A really small and simple setup for aquaponics. It seems a big concept for little kids.
Yeah, it is. That's why it's just focusing on the simple facts that we're reusing the water just to grow our own plants, and then we'll harvest them. At the moment, that's a bit hard for them to see because they're only new plants. But once the actual fruit started to grow on the plants, it all started to click for them. So it's a long process. Like, it takes them the whole year to really understand it all. But they, by the end of the year, they love it, and they get it and they understand why it all connects.
So what role do the students play? Do they have daily activities in connection with this aquaponics plant?
Yep, they feed the fish every day, twice a day, and we also went out to the barramundi farm to pick up our barra. So we had an excursion out there and watched and looked at their life cycle and how they made them like the different stages, and watched what happened out there and how they harvested. So the kids, once the barra start to grow, they understand that, oh, we're actually going to be able to eat them by the end of the year. So we harvest everything from it by the end of the year.
So talk us through the system. You've got, I can see the goldfish, haven't spotted a barra yet. That water is simply being pumped back into a bathtub containing a few plants.
That's it.
I also quite enjoy the drawings and the facts that are being put on big pieces of paper and they're stuck to the bathtub. Matilda says the fish poo goes into the clay balls and then the plants can grow from them. And Holly writes the yucky water goes into the red pipe, the blue pipe has the nice water. The clay balls then clean the water. And of course those clay balls are the soil that those plants are in. Why is it important that five-year-olds start understanding this?
Because they're the next generation. So they're so passionate about the pollution now and about keeping the marine life and everything, cleaning the water, making sure nothing goes down the drain. So they're so aware of that now. I've had parents telling me how annoying it is that they've had to pull over on the side of the road because there's been rubbish on the side of the road and their kids have chucked a tantrum in the car because they have to stop and pick it up because it's going to go down the drain and kill the fish.
So how many barramundi do you have in this pond?
We started off with 10. But a couple have died just because barra eat each other. So they've started to grow and the ones, we've got about 4 in there now.
When do you plan to harvest?
At the end of the year they should be plate size and we can eat them at plate size.
The Country Hour looks forward to coming out and visiting you on harvest day and chatting with the kids.
They get so into it. So they love it. They'll probably want to fish for them. We cleaned out the tank the other day after school and I had so many of the kids hanging around and they were helping me catch them and they were counting them and putting them into another tub.
All the best to you and your class in the barramundi. We'll see you later in the year.
Yes, thank you.
Can you remember if barra are male or female?
Male.
Male. Male. Why are they males?
Because they're in fresh water.
Yeah. And what happens if our barra grow to 55 centimetres? What can we do
Edge.
With them?
Eat them.
Oh, that's it. We can eat them.
Ashley Lidbetter and her young students from the Girraween Primary School at Humpty Doo in the Northern Territory. Looking forward to eating those barra later this year. Still to come on A Big Country, we get the lowdown on low-lying cattle and an army of ducks decimates an organic market garden on Queensland's Sunshine Coast.
Given it a snip as well. All I've done is done my pak choy, my buk choy, my cos, my oaks. So I didn't even harvest the oaks or the cos. So yeah, massacre, pretty much.
If you think you've got problems with snails in your veggie patch, then spare a thought for Mick Warren. This market farm manager on Queensland's Sunshine Coast is under attack from native wood ducks.
Quack attack.
Well, it is pretty much, eh?
But it's serious.
They don't eat the coriander. The beetroot's okay. But yeah, leafy greens. I hate them. What can I do? Not much.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Nichols. The wood ducks arrived at the Shambala farm near Noosa at the start of winter and have since enjoyed themselves nibbling their way through thousands of dollars worth of crops during the peak growing season.
For some of the lettuce, 100% crop loss if we don't net it. Like you have to net it or, yeah, just eat the whole lot, eh? It's crazy. This is what's left of the buk choy. And you can see it's just about mowed to the ground, these ones. Look at my cos even. The whole row's just about done there, isn't it? Pak choy. Even the kale that I haven't got under the edge of the net, they've just trimmed along the edge of that as well. And even my buk choy over here. Just everywhere you can see where it's not netted, they just eat it, eh? That's the only way at the moment that I can really stop them, net it. But they even get under the net as well, if I don't do it. Like here, you can see where it's a bit of a hole, I'll get under there and eat that. So really, like look at this bit here where the cos have eaten 6, 7 that aren't under the net. Little buggers.
They're just standing over there in the field looking at you right now.
Crazy, eh? What can you do?
I guess you're pretty stuck in that you've got houses on the outskirts of this sort of semi... what would you call a rural residential? So you're a bit stuck in terms of making noise.
Well, we've tried all types. I've tried like strobe lights, you know, like nightclub kind of flashing lights, and yeah, it works to a certain extent. I've tried electric fences, just nothing.
So netting's the only way to go.
The netting cover the crop, yeah. But yeah, it does get expensive if you want to net the whole lot.
For a while, trapping and relocation worked.
So yeah, Lynn, she's a real greenie, so she comes in and I give them to her and she takes them the last lot she took to Lake McDonald and released them out there.
But Mick Warren says the wood ducks have wised up to the trap.
See them all just starting to hang around? They're the ones that eat my crop. But they're not going into the trap, but I just rebaited it this morning, so they might go in, we'll see.
There's one heading towards it now.
Yeah, is he in there or is he at the back of it? See, they've just... I need to upgrade my trap, I think, and get a better system. Because they've just figured out it. See, it works like a crab trap, like a crab pot. They go in, but they can't get back out. Well, they're not smart enough, but they've gotten smarter. Now they are getting back out, so... Yeah, they're beating me at the moment anyway.
When do they start coming in?
On the full moon, they just attack all night. All day, all night. Just, yeah, 24 hours a day, they eat a day. Because the full moon gives them light at night time, so they can see, you know what I mean? So yeah, on the dark moon, they won't come out as much at night time. They'll be during the day, but they're quite tame. Yeah, you can just about walk right up to them.
How many ducks have you had marauding your crops? Because there's about 20 here today.
On the full moon, we could get up to 50, I reckon, for sure. It just depends. Like, you hear the noise that they make. They call their mates in as well. See, the guy with the red neck, he's the male one. He calls all the females in as well. See the two male ones sitting on the top and the one with the lighter neck, she's the female one. Well, that one might be in the trap, actually.
Should we go over?
Yeah, we'll have a look.
If we can get one ready for relocation. How fast do you have to move with this? Look, it's in there.
Did he come out?
No, it's in there. Oh, it was in there.
It's a water hen.
You've got a water hen that doesn't eat the crops.
No, he doesn't.
What's left of Mick Warren's premium leafy greens are now being mown back into the ground. He may have lost this battle, but he hasn't given up on winning the war.
We'll get them, definitely. We'll just get smarter of what we grow, won't we?
Use the lucerne to familiarise them. So, you know, morning and night, we'll come down, we'll hand feed them, we'll pat them, we'll get them used to that.
As far as Mandy Tennant's concerned, good things do come in small packages. What her cattle may lack in size, they certainly make up for in flavour.
Confirmation-wise, so we like a nice flat back line. He's got a good back line there. A nice tail set, so some of their tails can poke up in the air a bit, but he's got a nice flat one there.
Hello, I'm Lara Webster. The cattle in question are known as Australian Lowlines, a small, compact cattle breed standing just a metre tall.
We had a couple of the girls in here last night, and it obviously probably wasn't the best idea to leave them here. But rest assured, they haven't been in that paddock, so there's no fresh stuff down there.
Mandy and Kel Tennant have invited visitors to their farm, inland from Mackay in central Queensland today, to first meet the cattle and then eat the meat.
Mouthful. Wait till you finish what you've got in your mouth. Can your mother teach you any manners?
More than 50 guests have taken them up on their offer.
I'm Sue, and I'm now feeding a gorgeous little low-line cow here, whose name is Cupcake. Now, I love to eat cupcakes, but I don't know that I could actually particularly eat this cupcake for dinner, and the very fact that we're actually going to be eating Cupcake's relatives shortly. Don't think about it, la la la. But these are really cute cattle, and I think that if I was ever going to have one, that these ones would be really nice. But don't let me think about eating them, though.
Colin McPherson, you've had a chance to feed some of these lowlines. You've got up close and personal with them. What are your thoughts on what you're seeing?
Yeah, it's actually fascinating, the whole process that they've talked about, going from what's, you know, how they manage their ground to keeping them very, very calm, and then we eat them. Because of the quality of the meat.
And when we talk about eating them, and we don't want to talk too loudly because they're listening, but do you ever give this much thought? When you cook your steak up of a night, are you thinking about where it's come from, what's involved in that process, or do you just put it in your mouth and that's it?
Never think about it. I just hoe in. That's sort of, yeah, listening to it all today, it makes for a different view on it all, I must admit.
We sell to a lot of small acreage owners around the place, so low line are ideal for that because they're a smaller,
Very calm, you know, great temperament. So, you know, we sell quite a few, two or three at a time, to people who just want lawn mowers or pets or something to put in the freezer down the track. But often I don't think that's going to work. I can kind of see it in their eyes that, yeah, they're going to be pets for a long time. So,
Linda Clifford, it's fascinating. I think I find this most fascinating. I've worked in the food industry for a long time and have known about these sort of things, but to see it from the start, the ground roots, you know, is very fascinating.
Sharon Waterhouse, I'm just looking forward to tasting a good piece of steak.
Thank you. Before tucking into a low-line steak, I get Mandy to explain some of the finer points of the breed. One of her favourites is a young cow called Lucy.
Here we go. Oi.
She's absolutely beautiful. She's got a beautiful straight back line, lovely rounded rump. Close your ears, Lucy. Obviously, we're not going to eat Lucy. However, her progeny will, you know, will be nice beef steers, we hope. She's a beautiful deep cow as well as being wide. So the width gives you, obviously, your prime cuts along the back line there. So we like a nice wide cow. The temperament is very important, which goes towards food quality as well. So, you know, if they're quiet, stress-free, then at the end of the day, that comes through in the meat quality as well.
Let's talk about size, because she's only quite short, and standing here you can attest neither of us are particularly tall, and she'd have a bit of a hard time, I suppose, getting towards our hips. She'd be a little bit under us. So, I mean, how tall are they, roughly?
Yeah, look, normally the breed standard is around 110 centimetres. As I said, Lucy's a little bit shorter. But in general, they've still got the weight there. It's just that their legs are a lot shorter, which is fine because you generally don't eat the legs.
The chef responsible for feeding today's visitors is Ray Manning. It's the first time he's cooked with low-line beef, but he's already a fan. I find him hard at work in his outdoor kitchen.
Behind me here, I've got some of the Cloudbreak rib fillets that we're going to crust with some dukkha and cook those up on the barbecue. There's an eye fillet carpaccio there, so that's going to come out raw with some flavours and seasonings on top. Over behind you there, we've got some beef curry heating up here.
That's a pretty good smell.
Yeah, it smells pretty good, doesn't it? And then just over this way, I've got some beef ribs here basically marinating in a smoky barbecue and bourbon sauce. I'll just pop the lid back on that. They'll be beautiful. They're coming along nicely.
Are they particularly big steaks? I mean, they're only small cattle.
Well, look, I think for the size of the cattle, if you take a look at these rib fillets behind me, you know, we're still really getting close to an average size steak there is what you'd be used to seeing at your local, you know, butcher shop and in supermarkets. What I can say with this beef here, it's got beautiful fat and a big thick chunk of marble through the centre there. So when I cook those on a hot grill, that's going to become beautiful and tender when the fat melts through the steak. So they're a beautiful looking bit of steak. And why wouldn't they be? Have a look while they get to roam around out here in the paddock.
Talking to a few of the people here today who were feeding some of your lowlines, they were a little bit upset, or you might say a little bit emotional, about having to eat something like Lucy. How do you feel? You're raising these animals. Is there any emotional attachment once they're ready for the table?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, obviously things like Lucy we would never eat. You know, some of the steers, you spend 2 years nurturing them. They all have their own personalities. You get closer to some of them. Recently I took one to the abattoir and had a bit of a tear in my eye, but at least I know that it's, you know, he's had the best life possible. He's been absolutely spoiled. He's, you know, lived in the lap of luxury. So, and you can't keep them all, you know. And it's important, I guess, to get a product out there to people that people appreciate as well. So, yeah, it's a balance, but we're getting used to it.
Good food, yum.
Some satisfied visitors to Mary and Kel Tennant's low-line cattle property inland from Mackay in Queensland. Lara Webster brought us that report. You're listening to RN. I'm Anna Vito, and this is A Country Breakfast.